The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme.
Whether you call it a certificate, a passport, a validation, whatever you call it, it just seems to be inevitable that countries will want to know your disease status before you enter.
Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair speaks to Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak about how Europe can clear a path out of the pandemic. Also ahead, US President Joe Biden orders the first military action of his term on Iranian targets in Syria. We'll assess what and who America hit and why. Later in the show, the foreign ministers of India and China decide that it is past time that they swapped phone numbers, and we'll have our weekly calculation of what we know today that we didn't this time last Friday. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Though we should, of course, be thankful that the world is about to be in a position to have a row about vaccine passports, the world is about to have a row about vaccine passports. EU leaders began a two-day summit on the COVID-19 pandemic yesterday. There is division on whether countries should issue their own certificates or whether it should be a top-down EU protocol. Well, earlier, Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak discussed vaccine certificates and matters arising with former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair. We'll have some of that conversation shortly, but first of all, I'm joined by Chris in the studio. Chris, first of all, why did we decide to approach Blair to talk about this?
Well, we approached Tony Blair because he has been, for a former Prime Minister and independent citizen these days, if you will, relatively outspoken about vaccines, about the coronavirus itself, particularly with his the Tony Blair Institute, which has been doing a lot of research into these topics. Back in December, Tony Blair sort of made waves by being among the first to push, for example, that vaccines be administered, sort of the first dose be administered first as much as possible, and that the second dose be delayed so that as many people as possible could get a first dose of the vaccines, for example. And that was something that was then sort of taken up to some degree by the UK government and by others. So that was a big part of the reason, just that he has been quite involved, and we wanted to get a little sense of his thoughts on the process going forward, and for that matter, why he was involved in the first place.
That wasn't all you talked about, and obviously, given Blair's long record in British and global public life, there is a lot to discuss. So what other subjects did you get onto?
There is plenty, of course, that there was to discuss about global politics. We talked about the European Union and Brexit in particular. Also, for that matter, what the vaccine rollout, the differing vaccine rollout, says about the European Union and Brexit. We also discussed, of course, the US and the sort of special relationship between the US and the UK, which is something that Tony Blair knows very much about. And I sort of talked to him about how he would have handled Donald Trump, for example, and also issues like Hong Kong, because that was something, you know, he was involved in the handover of Hong Kong to China back in 1997. So those are some of the topics that will be in the April issue of Monocle.
Okay, we will have some of that chat very, very shortly. But first of all, let's go back to this EU debate on vaccine certificates. Where have, if anywhere, have they got to with this?
So they started this summit yesterday, a digital summit, and essentially what they agreed was that there was, quote, convergence on the idea of vaccine certificates. That's basically a polite way of saying we'd like the idea. It seems like something that could be feasible, but we can't agree on exactly how to do it. They've basically given, they're sort of saying in the next 3 months they have to figure out a plan for vaccine certificates. But there is still a lot of division between southern European countries that rely on tourism, want these vaccine certificates or passports in order to get tourism going again, and northern countries that are a bit more skeptical. So this was, and Tony Blair was also here, something, and this is what we're going to be hearing, quite passionate in his defense of vaccine certificates, or at least saying why they are so important. And we did also, to begin, I should say, ask him about the UK's own approach to easing of the lockdown, and the fact that it also sort of isn't going with a more tiered system within the UK when it comes to easing over the next few months.
Well, here is that portion of that conversation. This is Chris Chermak talking to Tony Blair.
The things my institute have been concerned about is to try and put in place, you know, the right infrastructure to get us out of this. So things like mass testing, you know, getting the vaccination program going at speed. These are the things we focus more upon, because all these other decisions, whether you have tiers or not, the precise speed of easing, I mean, they're incredibly difficult judgments. And the government was probably too eased too fast before, and so it's not surprising it's taking a cautious approach now. And I think most people would support a relatively cautious approach on this. The important thing is to realise whatever approach you take, and whether you have tiers or not, I think that the most important thing is to make sure that you have that infrastructure of containment in place, which includes mass testing, which the government, I think, have now come to, but I still think we should do in a much bigger scale. And secondly, that, you know, we then build for the future the infrastructure that's going to be necessary for either future strains of COVID-19 or future pandemics.
You've mentioned, or the Institute has also talked about favoring vaccine passports. And, you know, this is one thing that, of course, international travel will not continue for quite some time. It's something that it feels like has divided actually not just the UK, but also Europe, for that matter, with the idea of quarantines, quarantine hotels. Why do you think vaccine passports are a good idea? And do you expect them to be taken up?
I think whether you call it a certificate, a passport, a validation, whatever you call it, it just seems to be inevitable that countries will want to know your disease status before you enter. And they're already demanding to know that in respect of testing. So many countries you can't go into without a valid test certificate. We know that vaccination reduces transmission and reduces the likelihood of people getting the disease, obviously very considerably. It seems to be obvious that countries, if, for example, you're going to open up your tourist industry, other tourists will want to know what's the disease status or the vaccination status of the people I'm about to share a hotel with, I'm about to share a restaurant with. So I think this is inevitable. My point is, if it is inevitable, put in place a proper system now. Don't let a patchwork of different systems, different processes of validation grow up topsy-turvy, because you'll just find a lot of complexity and a lot of confusion. And you will also probably facilitate fraud. So you need proper validated systems. And the best thing is for the developed countries of the world to agree such a system between themselves. Or, for example, we're working on a program in Africa to allow a common travel pass between African countries. These things are going to happen. So my point is, get ahead of the curve, make sense of it. And I literally don't understand the arguments against it because, for example, quarantining people in hotels, I mean, that is a, you know, that's something that can work during the lockdown with a very small number of people who are prepared to put themselves through that. But, you know, the idea that if you're going to go abroad somewhere, you're going to go and quarantine first in a government hotel, I mean, it's absurd. Your international travel won't happen on that basis. So for all of these reasons, and because we have the technology capable of doing this in a sensible way, which protects people's privacy, just get it done.
Are you worried a bit on that front about perhaps also, I guess, a broader drive to close borders as a result of the vaccine, whether that's in Europe or elsewhere? I mean, do you feel that we've perhaps become too reluctant to open them again? You speak there about vaccination certificates, but do you expect most countries to really push to go back to international travel?
Countries will want to do international travel again, but they're going to be very concerned about it. One of the reasons why we spend a lot of time as an institute trying to make sure vaccination gets underway in the poorest parts of the world is that what will happen is those poor parts of the world will be cut off from the international community if you don't give them the means of being part of what, as I say, I think was just inevitable that it will happen, that countries like Britain will say, well, if you want to come in here, we need to know what your disease status is, that you've either been vaccinated or you've had a negative quality verifiable test. I don't. I mean, you know, people can make their own judgments about it, but as from a policymaker's point of view, if countries are already demanding proof of negative tests now and quarantine, why on earth, once vaccination is universal, are people not going to be asking what your vaccination status is?
That was the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair in conversation with our news editor Chris Chermak. For more of that interview, do pick up a copy of the April issue of Monocle magazine on a newsstand near you now or now about. Now here is Carlotta Ribello with the day's headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Hundreds of schoolgirls are feared to have been kidnapped in northern Nigeria. The attack happened when a group of gunmen arrived at a state-run secondary school with pickup trucks and motorbikes. Reports suggest the kidnappers were dressed as government security forces. The Chinese University of Hong Kong says that it has withdrawn recognition of its student union, saying criticism of the city's national security law by newly elected union leaders may have been illegal. It raises fresh concerns over academic freedom in Hong Kong. The tech giant Facebook has ended a blackout of Australian news on its site and announced preliminary commercial agreements with three small local publishers. The move reflected easing tensions between the social media company and the Australian government. And Joe Biden has quietly reversed Donald Trump's executive order promoting beautiful federal civic architecture. It means classical styles will no longer be prioritized in the design of new federal buildings. And you can find out more by heading over to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Carlotta. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. US President Joe Biden has ordered the first military action of his term, airstrikes against targets in Syria associated with two Iran-backed militia groups, Kataib Hezbollah and Kataib Sayed al-Shohada. According to one monitoring group, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the American strikes killed at least 17 militants. The action follows attacks on US assets in Iraq, including last month's rocketing of a coalition base in Erbil. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Holly Dagres, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and editor of Iran Source. Holly, what do we know for sure about what America hit?
Well, our understanding, Andrew, is that this was several facilities near the Iraq border in Syria. And what the goal here was that the Biden administration made a calculated decision to specifically not target Kataib Hezbollah targets in Iraq, but to do it in Syria because of fears of a diplomatic blowback in Iraq from the Iraqi government. So this was a very calculated decision. And of course, this was a retaliatory strike for last week's rocket attack on Erbil's airport, in which killed a U.S. contractor and injured several, including a U.S. service member.
I mean, these two groups, Kataib Hezbollah and Kataib Sayed al-Shahada, are described as Iran-backed, an adjective applied to many militia groups at large in the vicinity. Is there a way to explain in practice what does that actually mean? Are these groups that the Iranian regime is directly arming, equipping, funding, training, or are they just groups who have a vague ideological alliance to the Ayatollahs?
I think it's a mix of both, I would say. Yes, they are arming and have a very strong relationship. I think we should note the fact that the leader of Kataib Hezbollah, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was actually assassinated alongside Quds Force commander Qasem Soleimani in January 2020 with the U.S. drone strike under the Donald Trump administration. So there's definitely close ties there. But for it's really, I think, where things get murky is the fact that we don't know if the Iranians specifically tell them, hey, carry out these strikes or not. And I think that's where the murkiness lies, as if Iran's actually directing these attacks. Now, some experts would say, yes, they are. And actually, this is part of Iran's calculation to pressure the Joe Biden administration into reviving the nuclear deal. And this is part of several pressures or escalations they've been taking in recent months.
I mean, obviously, players on both sides of a ambiguous conflict like this will game out responses and, you know, how the person that they have struck might strike back or might not, and what they should then do in response to that. What would the Iranian leadership be inferring from this action by Biden if we assume that at some level those strikes against Erbil were an attempt to test him?
Well, I think before the strike happened, there was a sense that Biden was being too soft on Iran, that they were keen on getting this nuclear deal going. And so for the past week, we definitely didn't see this coming. And if you read closely the reports on what happened last night, you actually see that they were actually trying to assess and make sure they actually had the right militia groups involved and where they were going to hit targets. And now this is a relatively soft response than what I think maybe the Pentagon was hoping for, because Biden reportedly had been offered more targets and he had only singled out this one instance. So I think the Biden administration is drawing red lines without drawing red lines, saying that if you attack our interests and our troops in Iraq, we're going to hit back. And I think that's what people were hoping to see, and they hadn't seen the week prior.
Is there possibly a message in this from the United States to Iran about the nuclear deal, though, perhaps suggesting that if you do want the US back in this deal, and more importantly, perhaps you do want these sanctions lifted, then maybe it's about time you started to scale back your foreign enterprises in Iraq and Syria?
Well, if you remember, under the Trump administration, part of the goal of the maximum pressure policy was for Iran to change its quote-unquote malign behavior or its foreign policy in the region, to stop backing these proxy groups and to stop meddling in the internal affairs in neighboring countries. And so we didn't see any of that change. And what we've seen, though, in the recent months is that there was definitely a turn down of rocket attacks in Iraq. And this was the first time we actually saw something. And so for the Biden administration, I think they're trying to separate the nuclear issue from the Iraq issue, but also trying to make a point here that, yeah, just because we're trying to revive this deal with you, as we saw last week with the Biden administration announcing that they're willing to meet on the nuclear accord with Iran, but we're also going to draw red lines here where you cannot go after our troops and interests in Iraq.
Holly Dagres, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with the briefing on Monocle 24. Now, the idea of a hotline between rival nuclear superpowers seems a quaint relic of the Cold War, an era in which, with no other instant means of communication available, big red phones could be rung in the White House or the Kremlin to clarify whether these blips on the screen were an incoming missile assault or a flock of geese. Although, boringly, there were no actual red phones, and the hotline has in fact been, at various points, a teletype, a fax machine, and encrypted email, the idea has now been embraced by India and China. The foreign ministers of the two countries have agreed that a hotline might reduce the risk of further punch-ups between their troops along their disputed border. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Sajan Gohel, a visiting teacher at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Sajan, first of all, this is one of those stories which does prompt the thought that it's kind of weird that they haven't already done this. Shouldn't such a thing have been established sometime ago?
Yes, indeed. It's a very good point. Keep in mind also that India is an IT hub and China is one of the world's largest producers of technology. And you would have assumed that they would have found a way to have a more direct way of communicating. I think what has hindered this in the past is both countries have very large bureaucracies and they move somewhat slowly. It's good that the Indian External Affairs Minister, Dr. S. Jaishankar, has effectively decided to circumvent a lot of that and form a closer, direct a way of communicating with his counterpart, the Chinese Foreign Minister, Wang Yi. So the hotline is an important development. In theory, it may help them to coordinate and avoid conflicts from escalating. It also, I guess, drives home the growing importance of easing tensions between the both countries and to avoid the consequences of an escalating military conflict. We'll have to see how this plays out over time.
Because there have been, of course, over recent months, those clashes between Chinese and Indian troops along the border, and they have varied in severity. Some have just seemed like fairly harmless dust-ups between groups of bored young men operating at high altitude, but there have been serious casualties in some of them. How great is the risk, as China and India see it, of genuine escalation?
Well, in the past, as you mentioned, that some of the skirmishes were literally pushing and jostling amongst the troops of both nations, but last year, it intensified quite disturbingly, where you had hand-to-hand combat and pitched battles in which troops from both sides died. And it brought to the attention of the world that these border problems are unfortunately an ongoing challenge. And it was also concerning it was taking place in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it seems that both sides are keen to try and avoid that. What was, I think, very significant was the seminal statement by the Indian Foreign Minister, S. Jaishankar, at the end of January, in which he talked about the 8 guiding principles to rebuild India-China ties. Effectively, he was making a statement to China that if China wants to avoid the point of no return, there has to be a degree of respect on mutuality, specifically 3 aspects of mutual respect, sensitivity and interest. Now, what was interesting is that the Chinese took that very well. There was concern that that may create further problems, but on the contrary, it actually contributed to China then working with India to de-escalate tensions.
Sajan, thank you very much for joining us. That was Sajan Gohel from the London School of Economics and Political Science. You're listening to Monocle 24. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Finally on today's show, our weekly assessment of what we know now that we did not know 7 days ago. We learned this week who was really behind the Capitol Hill riot, which occurred in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. Are we using that effect too often? It feels like we could be. And that one? We appear to be drifting from the point. So, we learned that the Capitol Hill putsch might not have been what it appeared. We learned that while it might have appeared a massive collective tantrum thrown by the kind of people who believe that American presidential elections are fixed but American professional wrestling is not, it was in fact a cunning false flag operation intended to discredit the Republican ilk of the senator who spilled these beans, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, where voters clearly prize above all other considerations in a candidate a name which rhymes with the state.
Plainclothes militants, agents provocateurs, fake Trump protesters, and then disciplined uniformed column of attackers. I think these are the people that probably planned this.
This is, just so we're clear on this, absolute honking nonsense. But we learned from it that any hopes we might have indulged of conspiracy theory receding from its current regrettable prominence in public affairs appear to have been themselves as wretchedly delusional as the hypothesis of Senator Johnson. If we've decided nobody's counting how often we're thrashing these clips, let's have the agonized gear change one again. Because, and hang in there, this should just about work, we also learn something about the one work of art which most comes to mind when contemplating the current general scheme of things. We're going to interpret that as an answer to the clue rather than a comment on the segue. Yes, we learned that The Scream by Edvard Munch, the Norwegian painter who is renowned worldwide as the archetype of the despondent nihilist, except in Norway, where he is still recalled as the absolute life of the party, has hidden depths.
No. Fascinating.
Oh, really? Damn.
Oh, what? That blows my mind.
Really? No way. Blow me down.
We only made that clip a couple of weeks back, so that one's probably fine. We learned from new tests on Munch's famous existential daub by boffins at Norway's National Museum that Munch cunningly buried a penciled caption amid the painting's lurid whirls. And we learned therefrom that Munch's estimation of his own work was as follows, as now read in the closest thing Monocle can furnish to a Norwegian accent, i.e. the voice of our Scandinavian anguished desk chief, Finland's own Markus Hippi.
Can only have been painted by a madman.
We did not learn, but have since wondered whether there's more of this kind of thing secreted in the layers of other famous paintings, whether the Mona Lisa's smirk covers, hey, the Borgia's money is as good as anyone else's, or the zigs and zags of Picasso's Weeping Woman occlude I totally only did this for a bet, or folded into the tormented purple cyclones of Van Gogh's Starry Night is the admission, I'm phoning these in at this point. These highfalutin observations will flatter the audience by implying a lofty opinion of their general intellectual calibre. Was I not supposed to have read that out loud? And
high hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars.
We learned that despite nearly a year now of widespread Zoom-induced unkemptness, at least one institution remains doggedly determined to uphold sartorial standards. Hat off, top hat, naturally, to the UK's House of Commons, specifically Deputy Speaker Dame Eleanor Lang, who was emphatically not having it when one MP pitched up via video link to address the chamber while clad in a comfy jumper.
We don't go to Stoke-on-Trent. The honourable gentleman has to be dressed as if he were here in the chamber. So we will not go to Stoke-on-Trent.
In fairness to errant MP Jonathan Gullis, he does represent Stoke-on-Trent, where it is possible to become regarded as a swanky dresser by wearing shoes, but well played nevertheless to Madam Deputy Speaker. We require no such reminders here at Monocle 24, where our broadcasting dress code cleaves still to the example set by the glory days of the BBC. No waistcoat and tails, no microphone.
Tips his hat just like an English chappie.
We're off to polish our spats. This is not a euphemism.
Putting on the Ritz.
That is all for this edition of The Briefing. Another reminder that the complete interview of former Prime Minister Tony Blair by our news editor Chris Chermak will be in the April issue of Monocle magazine, and various further bits of it will be broadcast across Monocle 24 in coming days. Today's show was produced by Rhys James and Yolin Goffin. Our studio manager today was Louis Allen. The Briefing returns on Monday at the same time, midday UK. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific weekend.